Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. Senator Sarah Steelman of Rolla joins us for the first 25 minutes of this second hour. And then we'll be talking with Pastor Richard Stuckwish of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana. Emperor Constantine, last week Friday, May 21st, was the day that the church observed the remembrance of this, the first of the Christian Roman emperors. Was he really Christian? This whole story about the sign appearing in the sky by which he would conquer, is that story, is that a myth, a legend, or is it history? What was his role in the famous Council of Nicaea in 325 A.D.? We'll answer all those questions with Pastor Richard Stuckwish a little later here in this hour of Issues, Etc. In the third hour, Suzanne Ventker will be our guest. Part one of a seven-part daily series on working mothers. She's author of the new book, Seven Myths of Working Mothers. Do men have it all, and can women have it all, too? We'll answer that with her a little later in the program. Senator Sarah Steelman is a state senator from Rolla in Missouri. She's author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch on same-sex marriage and the Missouri Constitution. That'll be the subject for the next 25 minutes. Senator Steelman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Todd. It's good to be with you.
Senator Steelman, first of all, tell us about the proposed amendment that is part of your sponsorship in the Missouri Senate.
Well, Todd, it's SJR 29, and it's an amendment to the Missouri Constitution, and it very simply states that to be recognized as marriage in Missouri, it can only be between a man and a woman. And we would add that as a constitutional amendment to our own state constitution, augmenting the law that we already have on the books. We have in statute a law that basically says the same thing. But as you know, what we've seen in other states and what I'm afraid we may see here is that judges will undermine the will of the legislature and the will of the people and make their own rulings and overturn our statute if we don't have it as a constitutional amendment.
So this is a preventative measure to forestall any judicial activism that might play out in Missouri, the same thing that we've seen happen in Massachusetts of late.
Exactly. Massachusetts and California as well.
How do you respond? And there's a counterpoint column that appears there in the op-ed piece under the issue of gay marriage. How do you respond to Doug Gray, who says, and he says this is an issue, gay marriage, is an issue that doesn't even exist in Missouri? How do you respond to that?
Well, I think he's wrong about that. It does exist, and we've seen it, and we could see more of it, because it's obviously becoming a very... rapidly becoming a very fiery issue among the gay community. And, you know, in his column, I know he talks about, you know, he calls it discrimination, and I just simply don't agree with him that it's discrimination. It is simply defining marriage in our Constitution and what we've always known traditionally as marriage, legally as marriage. Our society has recognized a relationship between a man and a woman as marriage for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. So I don't agree with anything he says, basically, in his column.
So you would view the proposed amendment to the Missouri Constitution as simply putting into the Constitution what is already in law in Missouri.
Yes, that's right. But there, you know, the other arguments there. There's other legal arguments for the need to have it in the Constitution. If a gay couple challenges our statute, and they took it, let's say they went to under the U.S. Supreme Court under the U.S. Constitution, and they brought it under the full faith and credit clause of our Constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court looks at what the policy of the state is with regard to marriage. And what they will look at first is, do they have a constitutional amendment that states the will of the people, that was voted on by the people? And if a state does, expressing their will and the definition of marriage, then the U.S. Supreme Court is going to respect what that state has done.
So this is also this measure to amend the Missouri Constitution is also an attempt to allow a strong case to be made should, in defense of the Missouri statute, should it be challenged in the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yes, either in our state Supreme Court or as well as in the U.S. Supreme Court. That's two of the main reasons why it is necessary to do this.
Make the case, if you would, Senator Steelman, that both the DOMA statute, the Defense of Marriage Act, as it exists in Missouri, and the proposed amendment to the Missouri Constitution are not what many opponents of both of those things say, unconstitutionally discriminatory.
Well, I don't even think it's fair to call it discriminatory. I know they make the comparison between the civil rights movement, and I think that's just absolutely wrong and way off base. And we've had great civil rights leaders who have fought for very important liberties that were denied them. But this is not the case with marriage. Marriage has, you know, I like to say this is not about discrimination. It's about definition. And if we define marriage between a man and a woman, and we've treated it as a unique status in our society and legally, because men and women, you know, first of all, responsible for procreation, and then second of all, have the responsibility of bringing up children and all the parenting and responsibilities that goes with that duty, which is a very important status in our society. It is what keeps families together, and it is important to treat that as a unique status. If we start defining marriage as something else, where do we stop? I mean, I think that's the biggest question that the opposition has not been able to answer.
So it's really, it sounds like this is a discussion as much as anything else of the definition, not only of marriage, but of the term discrimination, because laws, by their very nature, discriminate between people who keep them and people who break them. Marriage laws discriminate between, say, people who are of majority and people who are still too young to marry. People who can legally marry and people who can't legally marry. Things like that. Laws, by their very nature, do this kind of, I guess you could call it neutral discrimination. You're saying, yes, it may be discriminatory in that legal sense, but not in the pejorative sense that is more commonly used.
That's exactly right. And you know, we do have laws that treat men and women differently, too. I mean, here in Missouri, there are things that are covered under, that are mandatory under health care insurance for women that aren't for men and vice versa. I mean, that men and women are not the same, and they shouldn't, you know, why would we presume that we treat them the same? We don't. And why would we presume that we treat marriage the same as we would any other couple, whether it's two male or two female? And then you make a very good point. We discriminate, and I hate to use that word because I think it is used pejoratively too much, but you know, we have certain requirements for licensing physicians. Not all people can practice medicine in this state. You have to get a training. You know, we have it defined as to how you become a physician or how you become a lawyer or how you become a lot of different professions, teachers. Does that mean we're discriminating? No, it means that we're defining this as to what it is and how you do that. We're not really denying anybody the right to marry. We're just saying that you cannot marry a person of the same sex.
Because the definition of marriage does not bear up under any other situation, any other arrangement.
Well, I don't think so. I don't see how one can make the argument that we ought to have marriage for couples of the same sex, and then how do you stop it there? Why not three people? Or why can't every business relationship between two or three people be called a, quote, marriage? I mean, I believe, and I think the majority of Missourians believe, that marriage should be treated in a unique and special way because it has unique responsibilities that have borne out for society, that are important to society.
We're talking with Senator Sarah Steelman. She's state senator from Rolla here in Missouri, about same-sex marriage. She's author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch on same-sex marriage and the Missouri Constitution. If you'd like to join us in this conversation, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. What about the issue of civil unions, Sarah? This seems to be one that, as various states craft their laws and their proposed amendments to their own constitutions, always seems to be a little bit of a loose end. We'll define marriage as a man and a woman, and some of them do and some of them don't address the issue of whether or not same-sex couples can then have civil unions. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think marriage, no matter what you call it, is special and should be between a man and a woman. You know, the opposition, those that argue on civil unions want to, I guess, they are wanting the same benefits that are extended to married couples, that are called married couples. I think a lot of those benefits are already available to them legally. They have to go get a lawyer and figure it out. I mean, that's, you know, part of the burden, I guess, that they don't like. But again, it's not that anyone is denying two people, whether it be two men or, you know, a mother living with a daughter, those kind of legal relationships. So I don't see the need for that. I think it already. I think if one wants to go, you know, figure out a way to have joint ownership of a home today, they can do that legally.
Would the proposed amendment to the Missouri Constitution speak to the issue of civil unions at all, or would civil unions be banned along with gay marriage by that name, marriage?
Well, I think it does, in that it will not recognize any relationship other than that between a man and a woman. And then we have our statute that specifically says, you know, that we're not going to recognize civil unions. So I think that we are covered here in Missouri if a couple comes and of the same sex and tried to get married in Missouri, that they could not do that, no matter what they call it. We don't have civil unions here. We just like we don't recognize common law marriage here in Missouri either.
Two final questions before we wrap this up, Senator Steelman. First of all, what role would an eventual federal marriage amendment play in this entire effort? Is it still necessary, given the fact that there may be impetus for a federal marriage amendment, to pursue one as far as the Missouri Constitution?
I think it will be necessary if there continues to be the kind of movement we've seen in the past year, the legal challenges that the gay community is bringing to the legal system. I think we will need a federal amendment. As you know, it's a lot harder. It takes a lot longer to get that kind of amendment to the United States Constitution, which is why I think it is just as important, if not more important, to make sure our state constitution has that amendment in it.
And then what about a timetable? Obviously, this is something that will have to work its way through the legislature. What course does it have to follow, and when could, at the earliest, Missouri voters have the opportunity to vote on a proposed amendment to the state constitution that would establish marriage as a man and a woman?
To the state constitution?
Yes.
Okay, well, we have already passed the Senate Joint Resolution 29, which I was the sponsor of. We passed that in this past legislative session. It is it is waiting to be signed, and then the governor is the one who calls the election. In the resolution itself, it stated that it was to go on the November ballot, this November.
And what will Governor Bob Holden likely do?
Well, the governor had last week actually stated that he wanted to put it on the August primary. He's taken it to court Friday and today, and the decision will be made tomorrow by the courts as to whether it will go on the November or the August election.
Is one preferable?
Well, in my view, the November election allows a lot more people to vote on it because, you know, unfortunately, not everybody votes in the August primary, but a lot more people vote in the November primary. So I think it's better for it to be, you know, where more people have an opportunity to vote on it. Plus, the timing is such because we just got out of the legislature that the Secretary of State has to go through certain, like a 10-day public review, and then there has to be a fiscal note attached, and that has to be done prior to the election. And I think the time frame for that has, for the August election, that is, has kind of expired, and it's really legally should go on the November election. In fact, the lower court on Friday ruled in favor of the Secretary of State as opposed to the governor, saying that it should go on the November ballot.
Do you, finally, with only about 30 seconds, do you see Governor Holden's attempt to try and put it on the August ballot as an attempt to basically make this state marriage amendment untenable for Missouri voters?
You know, I can only guess that he just thinks that it'll benefit him somehow to have it on the August ballot. I think, personally, it ought to go where the most people have the opportunity to vote on it, and that's always been in a general election where more people get out and vote. And he ought to be thinking about the will of the people as opposed to the politics of it.
Let's go to the phones here as our conversation winds up with Senator Sarah Steelman. Dennis is calling from his car. Dennis, welcome.
Hello, Pastor Todd. How are you today?
Very well.
And Senator Steelman.
Hi.
I read both of the editorials today, the pro and con, and I think in terms of the issue itself and what the gay community has, how they've distorted it, you know, I see this as a moral and an ethical issue, and they've drug it into the legal and the legislative process. And you know, I don't know how, you know, it got to this point of entanglement, but I don't know how we can get out of it when you have a small minority like the gay community, you know, trying to impose, you know, the choices that they've made in their life and try to make that into a legal issue when it's actually a moral and ethical issue. You know, how are we going to address this? And I'll hang up to hear the response.
Thank you, Dennis. It's a good question. Senator Steelman.
Well, I think he makes a very, very good point. This is not something that we have brought on. You know, I've been accused because I sponsored the amendment of making this an issue. The gay community has made it an issue, and they have made it a legal issue, and it is a moral issue, and it is an ethical issue, and it is an extraordinarily important issue, I think, for the survival of our children and our society, to make sure that we have couples, loving couples, who are raising our children with a strong moral upbringing. And you know, it's unpopular for people to talk about that, but that is not what gay marriage conveys. It just misses the mark. And that is a very important aspect of why we now need a constitutional amendment to protect that definition of marriage between a man and a woman. Kids need a mother and a father. And not all marriage in this state and country, as we know, are successful. But I don't think anybody would argue that even though marriage between men and women are not always successful, that it is the best environment for the child to be brought up in with loving parents, if at all possible, and that's what we should strive for as a society.
Senator Sarah Steelman, thank you for being our guest and your work there in the Senate in Jeff City. Thanks for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Senator Sarah Steelman is state senator from Rolla, author of a column in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch on same-sex marriage and the Missouri Constitution. Now, as we prepare to begin a conversation with Pastor Richard Stockwish on Emperor Constantine of the 4th century, the first Christian Roman emperor, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month is being a Lutheran something that only only has its origins in the 16th century, so, well, relatively late in Christian history? Or are the beliefs that are encapsulated in the Lutheran faith really historic Christendom itself? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month is called Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. Now, in this great book, Pastor Daniel Preuss, a regular guest here on Issues Etc., answers not only the question, why I'm a Lutheran, he says he's answering the question, why am I a Christian? What makes a person a Christian? The answer, in brief, Jesus at the Center. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it from Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their toll-free number is 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. You can visit them and get the book at one of two locations, at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis, or here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. You can also browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information there on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center, by Pastor Daniel Preuss. As we go into this break, let's start a conversation that takes us back to the 4th century. Emperor Constantine, back last week, on Friday the 21st, was the day upon which the Church observes and remembers this first Christian Roman emperor. Pastor Richard Stuckwish is our guest, pastor of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana. Pastor Stuckwish, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Yeah, thank you, Don.
Give us the briefest biographies on Emperor Constantine with 2 minutes before we go to our break, and then we'll flesh it out on the other side of the break.
Okay, well, he was Roman emperor at the beginning of the 4th century, and through a series of primarily military maneuvers, he became the sole emperor of the entire Roman Empire at that time, and for various reasons showed real favor to the Christians and to the Christian Church, which brought to an end many years of persecution and enabled the Church to prosper in many ways, ways that people have mixed feelings about. But in any case, he was extraordinarily important to the history of the Christian Church at that time and is remembered for that reason.
Very briefly, just clear up one little bit of confusion that often persists. Did he merely decriminalize Christianity within the Roman Empire, or did he Christianize the Roman Empire? Did he make Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire during his reign?
In answer to the second part, technically no, although he certainly paved the way for that. And there were actually a series of things that happened under Constantine, the first of which was, as you say, to decriminalize Christianity. But more and more it became a favored religion, and one could say that it was an official religion of the Roman Empire, though it really did not become the religion until subsequent generations.
When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, briefly begun here with Pastor Richard Stuckwish of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana, about Emperor Constantine. Stay with us.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, host of Issues Etc., inviting you to join Gene Edward Veith, Craig Parton, and me for a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 6th through the 12th at the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center in Trago, Wisconsin. I'll be speaking on the fad-driven church and mere monotheism. Dr. Veith's topic will be a confessional understanding of the times, and Craig Parton will share his expertise on the grandeur and misery of American evangelicalism. A Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar is a week-long seminar helping Christians understand how popular culture and religious trends conflict with the biblical worldview. For more information, call the Schwann Center at 1-800-577-4848, 1-800-577-4848, or check out our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June 6th through the 12th at the Schwann Center in northern Wisconsin.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Stuart Shepherd. Teenagers are increasingly avoiding many risky behaviors, according to a report from the Centers for Disease Control, but there's still substantial room for improvement. Keith Peters reports.
The past 12 years have seen improvements in risk behaviors related to sexual activity, injuries and violence, plus tobacco and alcohol use, according to the CDC. But Kristen Moore, president of Child Trends, says the message about high schoolers having sex is mixed.
There have been some good declines, a reduction in the proportion of kids who have had sex. Nevertheless, we still have about half of adolescents who are exposed to sex during their high school years. So we've made progress on a number of things, but we still have a ways to go.
Linda Klepacki of Focus on the Family says the decline in sexual intercourse can be directly attributed to abstinence-only programs.
We're seeing that continuously. We have seen that continuously since abstinence until marriage education came into fruition in 1996 with legislation.
Moore says research has shown a very important factor in adolescents avoiding risky behavior is parents.
Families trump other influences. I often think that parents don't recognize how important they are in the lives of children. So if they want to help their children prevent doing risky things or help promote kids doing positive things, parents need to be involved in the lives of their children all the way through adolescence.
Linda Klepacki urges parents to talk to their teenagers. She says you don't have to know the latest statistics. Just love them and tell them about your family values, like abstinence until marriage. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
Other improvements include a drop in cigarette smoking and alcohol use by high schoolers, and the number who had been in a physical fight dropped from 43% in 1991 to 33% in 2003. The report includes data from 32 states. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd.
The Missouri Historical Society marks the centennial of the Louisiana Purchase Exposition, better known as the 1904 World's Fair, with the opening of the 1904 World's Fair, Looking Back and Looking Forward, an exceptional new exhibition at the Missouri History Museum, Lindell and DeBolivar in Forest Park. The free exhibition opens to the general public on Sunday, May 2nd. It embodies the sights, sounds, and splendor of the 1904 World's Fair, and it's free.
Our Issues Etc. book of the month for May is Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Daniel Preuss. You can find out more on our website, issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section, or you can call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. The title again, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the middle of the second hour of the program, we're continuing our conversation on Emperor Constantine. May 21st is the day on the church's calendar that she chooses to remember this Christian ruler, Emperor Constantine. A lot of myth and misinformation swirls around about Constantine. Some of it old, some of it newer. Dan Brown, in his best-selling book, The Da Vinci Code, basically comes out and says that Constantine invented Christianity. And he did it through a kind of forcing his political hand at the Council of Nicaea in 325, and that's where they invented Christianity as it exists today. Before that, says Dan Brown, it was a goddess religion, but Constantine saw to it that that was taken care of. We'll find out whether that's true or even has a shred of truth to it in the course of this conversation with Pastor Richard Stockwish. Feel free to join us, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Pastor Stockwish, a few other basic questions.
Okay.
The story through which most people are introduced to Emperor Constantine, even more famously than the Council of Nicaea, is this "by this sign you shall conquer" story, where
right.
Constantine, apparently on the eve of a battle, sees a cross, a Cairo, something in the sky, and receives a message from God. What is to this story?
Well, there, we can't speak with absolute certainty, other than to say that apparently he had some sort of vision, which he interpreted as a sign from and of the God of the Christians, and he interpreted this and understood this to mean that if he showed favor to the Christians, then their God would show favor to him. Now, you can sort of understand why Christians have a mixed feeling about this, but it was on the occasion when he was about to seize the city of Rome, I think from one of his brothers or other relatives. As I said, there were a lot of military campaigns and political maneuvers going on in which he eventually was able to become the sole emperor of the entire Roman Empire and to reunite it under his rule. And at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, just outside of Rome, is when he had this vision, whatever it may have been, whether it was a cross or a Cairo or whatever it was. He basically made a decision at that point that he would see how it worked, and he won the battle. And so apparently he interpreted all of this as a sign that it was in his best interest to show favor to the Christians and to rely upon the Christian God to help him in his endeavors.
Was Constantine himself a Christian?
Well, as with most of the questions you're going to ask me today, I have to give sort of a mixed answer. He considered himself a Christian. He clearly believed in, shall we say, the power of Christ, and he was baptized on his deathbed, and there are various reasons for that. He was not baptized prior to that point. So from a technical standpoint, especially by the standards of that day, he would not have been considered a Christian, properly speaking, but he did consider himself a Christian and described himself as a Christian, certainly favored the Christian church in his lifetime. But he also took part from time to time in various things pertaining to the old pagan religions of the Roman Empire, and whether that was due to some kind of syncretism on his part or if it was more a case that he felt obligated as the emperor of the entire body of people to serve all of his subjects regardless of their religious confession or faith, it's a bit difficult to understand. That dilemma, if you will, was probably part of the reason that he waited until his deathbed to be baptized, simply because as emperor, he was, by his very office, if you will, involved in activities that were forbidden to baptize Christians. And it may have been that he simply put off his baptism so that he would not be entangled in what might have been regarded as a conflict of interest. I'm not condoning any of this necessarily, but from a historical standpoint, that seems to be the case.
Did his, and I'll put this in quotes, did his conversion, did it spark a popularity of Christianity among the Roman rulership, among the Senate, with other rulers following Constantine's suit in this, you know, taking part in this new burgeoning Christian religion?
Well, yes and no. I don't think his personal conversion, however one wants to understand that, and I think it probably was not a, you know, the thing at the Milvian Bridge in his vision, I don't think was the end of the story in that regard. I think he probably developed in his faith over the course of his lifetime. But I don't think his personal conversion made nearly as much of a difference as the favor that he showed to the Christian church, and especially after Christianity was not only decriminalized, but was really given a lot of advantages, if you will, within the political and economic realm. Certainly, there were lots of people who began joining the church for somewhat questionable reasons. We can't read people's hearts, obviously, but it was a matter of consternation for the Christians at that time because previously, especially when the church was under persecution, you generally didn't have people becoming Christians apart from a genuine conviction and commitment because in many cases they were very likely to be put to the test and even put to death simply for bearing the name Christian. So there was a long process of catechesis. In some cases, people would have been alienated from their families. They might have had to give up their jobs or been fired from their jobs. And under those circumstances, when people came into the church, you more or less expected that they were going to be active and committed members to the life of the church. Well, when Christianity becomes favored and the church as such is receiving endowments for various building projects and it becomes socially acceptable and even a matter of status to belong to the Christian church, then you have a rather large influx of people who, to varying degrees, attach themselves to the Christian church, become card-carrying members, if you will, And there was a certain laxity that came along with that. And again, I'm not necessarily evaluating all of this, but from a historical standpoint, a lot of things were really shaken up and had to be reevaluated in the process. And probably some things were the better and some things were the worse.
I'm a little perplexed by what appears to be a rather rapid, I'm not going to say growth of the church, but we get this picture, and this is probably due more to just historical inaccuracy and wishful thinking on the part of Christians nowadays, that before Constantine, you've got this ragtag, largely disparate group of Christians with no organization whatsoever, period. They just have no organization. Their worship is completely spontaneous. They don't have anything approaching kind of a hierarchy or anything like that. Then all of a sudden, here comes Constantine. He decriminalizes the thing. Next thing you know, you got the Council of Nicaea. You got bishops and deacons and theologians and people coming from all over the place. Where did all the organization come from?
Well, yeah, I think what you're right in saying that a lot of this is simply a misperception of history. And most of what you just said, if not all of it, is simply untrue. The church had a very clear organization. Now, it wasn't necessarily organized in the same way from one geographical area to another, and that's still true to this day. I don't think you've ever had a case in the history of the church in which the entire church around the world was all organized in exactly the same way, much less organized into a single body or organization. But you already had a fairly elaborate hierarchy, if you want to use that terminology, prior to Constantine. Various levels of office, different clergy serving in different ways. The church, this was true already in the first century. It certainly didn't have to wait until the fourth century for Constantine. What really changed with Constantine was, I suppose, the legitimacy from a social and political standpoint, the economic prosperity of the church, the fact that after several centuries of at least intermittent persecution, suddenly the church was by and large freed from that kind of persecution and was able to focus on, was able to start putting things into writing and publishing things in the context of the day and growing and ways that previously they had not been able to. But to say, for example, with respect to worship, that prior to this point it was just spontaneous is simply not true. There was a very clear pattern and organization to it, and we have evidence of that from not only from the New Testament itself, but from writings of church fathers in the second century and really throughout that time period. So those perceptions are simply not correct.
Let's talk about the Council of Nicaea in 325 A.D., what was its occasion? What was Constantine's role in the whole matter, and what was it about?
Okay, Constantine was concerned about theological arguments that were going on within the church, and these arguments had to do with the divinity of Jesus and of the Son of God, really. There was one group usually identified with the name of Arius and known as Arianism, which said that the Son of God was a creature, and sort of a creature that stood between the one God and the rest of creation. And it was this creature that was incarnate as the Son of Mary and our Savior. Well, clearly this attacked a very fundamental article of the faith, and there were others who stood hotly opposed to this. And then there were a bunch of others who really weren't entirely clear about the issues and did not have their minds firmly made up one way or the other. But the issue itself was complex enough and fundamental enough and fierce enough that it attracted the attention of Constantine. And one has to understand that his concern was not primarily the theological issue, but just as a number of the pagan emperors before him had really tried to provide for the unity of the empire through pagan religions, Constantine was interested in seeing Christianity become the binding glue or cement that would hold together the unity of the empire. And he saw it from a very pragmatic standpoint. And the church, the Christian church, could not very well unite the empire if the church itself was not united. And this theological argument was clearly a divisive issue that was dividing the church and therefore hindering his political hopes and aspirations. So he initially sent one of his ecclesiastical advisors, who was actually from Spain, I believe, and a Western theologian, to sort of try to reconcile the different parties. Well, this guy came back. I believe his name was Hosius, and it's variously spelled and pronounced. But he came back and said, well, the issues here are too profound and too complex. We're not simply going to be able to reconcile people. Basically, there is a right answer and a wrong answer, and you're not going to be able to get these people to compromise and to agree. It was at that point, then, that Constantine called for a council of bishops. And this was a pretty significant thing. This is what became the Council of Nicaea, and it was an important historical development in the way the church addressed these kind of issues. It was also very, very political. Nowadays, you'll sometimes hear people bemoan politics in the church as though it were a dirty word or necessarily a bad thing. Obviously, politics can be abused, but the Council of Nicaea was very much a political event, and there was a lot of political maneuvering involved, which eventually led to the confession of the true faith, which we to this day confess in what we call the Nicene Creed. And it was at that council that the argument was carried out among the bishops of the church. There were over 300 bishops at the council. And the end result was the addition of a word in particular to what had been the basic baptismal creed. And it wasn't exactly the same from place to place, but it had essentially the same structure. And it would have been similar to what we recognize as the Nicene Creed, but it differed from place to place. And it did not include the phrase of one substance with the Father, or consubstantial with the Father. In Greek, the term is homoousios. It means of the same nature, basically, or the same substance. And it was not a biblical word. It was a theological term that this fellow Hosius from Spain may well have recommended to Constantine, and then Constantine perhaps was the one who suggested it to the bishops as a way of trying to identify the relationship between the Son of God and his Father, that they were indeed both of the same divine nature and of one nature, the two of them, the two persons, without resorting to another theological problem that had really reared its head in the previous century, which was to equate the three persons of the Trinity as though they were simply different modes or different masks, and that there weren't actually three distinct persons, but just this one God who appeared in various different ways. And that was one of the reasons this all was so complicated. Nobody wanted to fall back into that older heresy, but there were those who recognized that clearly the Son of God had to be true God himself if he was to be our Savior.
Pastor Richard Stuckwish is our guest. We're talking about Emperor Constantine. If you have a question or a comment on that, or the Council of Nicaea, which is one of the major historical events over which Constantine had some say, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Car phone callers, first-time callers, and internet callers get top priority, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Pastor Richard Stuckwish is pastor of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana. All right, so we have this council that is called by Constantine in order to, for a twofold purpose. One, because he is, at least as far as we can tell, concerned about the doctrinal rift that had developed in the church between Arius and what would eventually be Athanasius,
right.
The two figures who kind of stood for these two, one an errant view of Christ, another the Orthodox view of Christ. Two, he had political goals to be met here, and that is the unification of the Roman Empire.
Right, and that was really his personal primary concern.
What role did he play in the council itself? Did he have any official role? Was he just kind of a political observer of this thing?
Well, depending on who you read, you're going to get different answers to that. Some people will say that he may have actually chaired the council or presided over the council, and others will say that he was simply there as an observer and he let the bishops chair and preside. My own feeling is that there was probably some of each, that he may have chaired the meeting at some points, but otherwise sort of stepped back and let the bishops fight it out. Interestingly, I should comment that neither Arius nor Athanasius were bishops themselves, and so it was actually bishops who fought this out, and Athanasius was there, but he was only a deacon at that point and was not able to participate in an official capacity.
One of the things that seems rather foreign to us is the very early melding of the secular and the sacred in the person of Emperor Constantine, because here at the Council of Nicaea, if I read my history correctly, he did employ the power of the state at one point against Arius. He had the power to exile him, which he did, and then one of his successors had the power to return Arius from exile. One of Constantine's successors also sends Athanasius for a time when he's out of favor into several exiles, using political, secular power to do so.
Well, and actually, Constantine himself, if I understand correctly, banished Athanasius for a while and actually brought Arius and some of his supporters back out of exile. Constantine was not really a theologian in his own right at all. And his degree of catechesis as a Christian was fairly minimal. And so it really depended on who his advisors were at any given moment as to which way he was leaning. And really, for the next 50 or 60 years, even after the Council of Nicaea, these battles were not over. They had to continue to be fought. And there were many people, like Athanasius, for example, who suffered great personal hardship in the defense of the faith. And I would say ultimately, well, without question, it was only by the providence of God that the church prevailed in these matters and was able to retain the confession of the true faith in one true God and three persons in one God. So Constantine himself, to a certain extent, was sort of blowing in the wind. And again, it was because his primary concern was for the unity of the empire. And it's not to say that he wasn't concerned about matters of Christian faith, but unfortunately, like a lot of people in our own day, he regarded arguments over theology and especially over the nature of God as trivialities or of less than real importance, and let the theologians debate about those things, but really that's not what the church is about, and can't we just all get along? And I think politically he was a very sophisticated man, obviously very accomplished. He was very savvy in that regard, and that was the sort of expertise, if you will, that he brought to bear upon the life of the church. Now, having said all of that, the idea of having a council in which you bring together bishops from really all over the church to publicly debate matters of theology and to deal with them according to a rule of order. Nowadays we use Robert's Rules of Order. Obviously they didn't have that back then, but to do so in a public sort of forum according to rules of debate, I think that was a very salutary and very helpful thing to do. And in that respect, I think Constantine introduced something that was very helpful to the life of the church. Now, the practice of exiling people, that was kind of an unfortunate thing in some ways. That was, in my opinion, a mixing of the secular realm and the ecclesiastical realm that probably caused as much harm as good. And over the next century, you have people going in and out of exile left and right, and it was probably not so helpful.
Finally, with only a few minutes here, did this really begin on that melding of secular and sacred? Did this really begin the road that we see kind of come to fruition very late in the history of the well, it's hardly even the Roman Empire any longer. It's then the Holy Roman Empire, where at the time of the Reformation we find the Pope is powerful or more powerful than the Emperor. The Emperor becomes a pawn and sometimes a player in this whole chess game of church and state. Did it all begin with Constantine?
Well, I think in a sense you can say that, yes, it did begin with Constantine. I don't think that one can really draw an unbroken line from Constantine through all of those different developments. There were so many different historical factors coming into play from one generation to the next. What may have been more significant in that regard is the fact that Constantine, toward the latter part of his reign, relocated the capital city of the empire from Rome to what had been known as Byzantium and was renamed as Constantinople. And I think this is the same city that then became Istanbul. I'm a little foggy on some of
it. It is. Yeah, same city.
That was pretty significant because over the course of the next century, Rome itself really became overrun with barbarians, and in the vacuum that was created by the departure of the empirical government from Rome to Constantinople, the papacy really kind of stood alone and as a leader, not only within the church but politically speaking, in the western part of the empire. So that in the course of the 5th century, for example, and the 6th century, it was often the Pope that really provided leadership and stability and unity to not only the city of Rome, but to the western side of the empire. And that was one of the reasons that the papacy then kind of naturally acquired this political prominence and political power, which obviously led to some very unfortunate developments over the course of the Middle Ages. Part of that was because of the vacuum that was created by the movement of the empire from Rome to Constantinople. But on the other hand, if Constantine hadn't made that move, it's difficult to say whether the empire would have survived as long as it did or been able to hold together as well as it did, because as the barbarians came in, things were sort of overrun.
Pastor Richard Stuckwish, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
It's always my pleasure.
Pastor Richard Stuckwish is pastor of Emmaus Lutheran Church in South Bend, Indiana. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be discussing, we'll move ahead four centuries to the 8th century theologian. I learned of him as Venerable Bede, Bede the Venerable. Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamwell, Illinois, will be our guest tomorrow to talk about that 8th century theologian. When we come back from this break, Suzanne Venker joins us for the first in a 7-part daily series on working mothers. The first myth, men have it all. So, gee, why can't women have it all, too? Suzanne Venker, author of the book 7 Myths of Working Mothers, will be our guest in the third hour of Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.